Okay. Beautiful day today. Bad leg, huh?
Become part stormtrooper.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that on Facebook you talked about. Yeah. Is it healing well?
I've had no pain since it happened.
Perfect.
I feel
Yeah, you are.
really lucky.
Yeah, very good. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about wholeness. And how I've come to understand what it is. Last month I talked about salvation in Buddhism, and salvation in Buddhism turns out to be nirvana, according to me, the end of suffering. So what we're trying to do is find salvation in nirvana to end our suffering as a human being. But then we come to wholeness, and wholeness, I think, is a whole different ballgame for a Buddhist because a lot of people think there's something missing, and if they find the missing part, then they'll be whole. And perhaps if you have a faith or belief in God, that creating that relationship or realizing that relationship with God will be the key to your wholeness. And there's a wonderful metaphor about a beach and a person walking on the beach who feels he's been rejected by God, and because there's only one set of footsteps. And so God miraculously appears and said, "Well, there's only one set of footsteps because I am carrying you on the beach." And you see that line over there? When I got tired of carrying you, that's where I dragged you. So that's one way of looking at relationship and wholeness. And there's also a few other ways. But I'm thinking, well, what would wholeness be in Buddhism? Don't we have everything we already need to achieve nirvana? And as it turns out, absolutely. We simply lack the realization. And in order to experience the realization, we need to get rid of the things that prevent us from experiencing our perfection as a human being. And of course, those things are greed, hatred, and delusion. And it takes a really long time to transform greed, hatred, and delusion, because it seems to be one of our partners through our entire life. In my own case, as I sought wholeness, I started out in an interesting way, perhaps in the same way we all started out. But I was a stammerer and stutterer for half my life. And as I look back on it in preparing this talk, it seems to me that I felt separate and didn't feel connected. And when I was called on to speak in class in grade school, I just froze. And like nothing would come out. I know it's hard to believe now, but it was but it was a traumatic experience every time I had to stand up and people looked at me. And I'm thinking, why would that be the case with hindsight and age? And it seemed that I always felt separate and never felt whole and never felt connected, and always felt like there was sort of a piece either missing or deformed. And if I just figured out what piece that was, then I would be whole, and then I could speak, and then I could feel comfortable in groups and in the human experience. So when I got to my 20s, I bought a book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. I thought that would be the key. And I read the book, and I realized what I was trying to do is change my ego. I was trying to add the pieces that I felt weren't there. And if my ego was working fine, then I could speak and feel comfortable in groups. And then I bought a book called Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill. And I thought that might help as well. So I'd be completely formed and I'd be rich too. And that sounded fine to me. And but you know what? It never worked. In fact, it sometimes worked against me because I was working so hard to create an ego that felt comfortable being separate. And so I'm thinking, what do I need to do not to feel separate? What do I need to do? Well, in my 30s, I started to meditate on a regular basis, 28, 29, 30, started to meditate on a regular basis. And in my mid-30s, something happened to me in Palms, Mar Vista, Culver City. That sort of became, you know, the place where the first experience of wholeness happened for me. And what I was doing, I was just meditating and I was counting my breath, and as I had done for weeks and months before. And there I was just sitting there, and all of a sudden there was light, and there was sound, and there was energy, and there was a transcendent experience, a non-dual experience, if you will, that lasted for I don't know how long, because I don't know when it started and I don't know when it ended, which is one of the problems with non-dual experiences. But afterwards, there was a calmness and serenity that sort of pervaded my whole being. And I went, wow, this is really cool. So I got my tape recorder, and I said a few words into my tape recorder about my experience, because I didn't want to forget it. And I was thinking to myself, maybe I could recreate it. And I found the tape a few years ago, and I was very mellow. I didn't say anything profound, like I had hoped I would. But I was just, like, really serene. And for 2 years after that, I tried to reproduce that experience and came to the conclusion that everything only happens once. So you can have similar experiences or different experiences, but never, ever the same one again. So that was my first non-dual experience. And I remember a talk that I had listened to when I was in my 40s, that Ram Dass was speaking. And he was speaking about an experience he had in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and he was in San Francisco, and he was giving a talk, and most of his audience were young and dressed in white and had far too much hair. And they were just listening to him, and in the front row, it turns out, was this little old lady. She had a straw hat with fake fruit and professional black lace-up shoes on, with a skirt that modestly went below her knee. And I thought to myself, well, this little old lady was 70, according to Ram Dass, and now I'm 66 and doesn't sound so old anymore. So there was this lady sitting in the front row, and she was just agreeing with him all the time. So he would go to these drug-induced, non-dual experiences, and the young in the audience knew exactly what he was talking about, but it seemed that she did as well. And he couldn't figure out how she would know. So at the end of his talk, it is customary to stand in line and hug him. And so she's in line, and he's getting ready to ask, how do you know? So here she is. And he said to her, did you understand what I was talking about? And she said, oh, absolutely. And you said it so well. He said, have you ever taken LSD? She chuckled and said, no, no. Do you do yoga? How do you know? She said, I crochet. And when I heard that, I just cracked up, because I realized there are so many different ways to have a non-dual experience. On the beach, in the morning, in the evening, it can happen anywhere at any time. And I think for most of us, if it does happen outside our spiritual practice, we might think we're getting the flu or food poisoning. Something isn't working right. But it was really a transcendent place. The next time that happened to me was in Illinois, and I was part of an interreligious conference at a Catholic monastery, which is sort of a fun place to go to. And I was going to speak about Buddhism. Well, I looked around the room and realized all these people were far smarter than I was. They had amazing credentials when it came to college and university, and most of them were PhDs or at least masters, who had studied religion and their religion and philosophy and humanity. And what could I possibly say that would inspire them or let them think I was at their level? So the night before was a restless night, and I got little or no sleep. And I remember waking up and sort of fearing this presentation I was about to make. And it was my turn, and they called my name, and I went to the podium, and I disappeared. The guy who was going to give the talk decided not to give the talk. So there was this body standing there speaking about Buddhism, and all of a sudden, everybody was engaged in listening, and it seemed to go well. I don't know who was speaking, and I sat down, and I sort of came back together again, and people were saying, that was a really good talk. And I started to get the clue now that maybe, you know, the ego has real limitations when it comes to doing stuff like that. And the ego, in giving a presentation, would talk to the egos of the listeners. And it would be the intellect communicating with the intellect of others. And if you've ever been to an intellectual presentation, they're talking to about four people who understand what they're saying. And the rest of the people are just going, yeah, okay, maybe, I don't know. I didn't read that page. And so I started to understand that perhaps in giving a good Dharma talk, rather than going after the intellect, we need to go after the heart. And in order to go after the heart, you have to go beyond the ego. The ego is there to defend and define who you are. But it's not good at communication or connecting, interconnecting. Now, the third time it happened to me was after 2 years of harmonica practice. And one day I picked up that harmonica and performance occurred. And in order for performance to occur, the ego had to be present and accounted for 2 years in the practice situation. Would have to read and understand and listen and carefully analyze and critique and criticize. And when all that stuff fell away, there was simply performance. It was simply the harmonica playing itself. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. In my mid-30s, I stopped stammering and stuttering because of, I think, my non-dual experience. There was nothing physical about it. There was something psychological about it. It was something that happened at some point in my life that made my ego feel it was defective or insecure or not good enough to participate. Whatever it was, it allowed me to see the world in a very separate way, and my spiritual practice has allowed me to see the world in a very connected way. And in feeling connected, there's less need to feel independent. You know, self-awareness can also be self-conscious, and it's a very uncomfortable feeling sometimes. And people say, you know, egos are just wonderful little vehicles. Well, they're necessary vehicles, that's for sure. In a talk I just listened to by Ram Dass done in the mid-80s, he came up with a term that I had never heard before. It was called vertical schizophrenia. And I thought, wow, that is so cool because I suffer from it too. Now, let me tell you what it is, according to Ram Dass. Ram Dass, as you may or may not know, was Richard Alpert, and he was a professor at Harvard University with Timothy Leary. And they are two of the only professors to ever get fired. And they were fired because they were giving the students LSD and measuring their spiritual responses, you know. And they had the placebo group, you know, just to see if LSD really did work. And it was good. So after Harvard, Richard Alpert went to India and found a guru and became Ram Dass, a servant of God. Okay, this is a big jump from Richard Alpert to servant of God, Ram Dass, to sort of take that title, that name, that ambition, that potential, if you will, and put it on and wear it. And so Ram Dass, in his talk, talks about when Richard Alpert would materialize unexpectedly. For instance, they'd be in an ashram and they'd be doing yoga and they would be talking, he'd be talking to some of the students, and all of a sudden he was attracted to one of them. So his Dharma talk went to, wouldn't you like to come up and see my spiritual paintings? And he realized at that point, Richard Alpert had materialized unexpectedly, and Ram Dass had gone away. Now, I'm listening to this, and there was Carl. He was the guy that was born, you know, and studied for a really long time. And then Carl decided to be ordained and become Kusala. Ah, so now he had to wear Kusala. And sometimes as Carl's walking around and just looking at the world, Kusala is nowhere to be seen. In driving here today, there was no Kusala at all. It was Carl. He's got the car insurance. He's got the driver's license. He's trying to avoid wrecks along Vermont Avenue. Then Carl gets out of the car and picks up his little bhikkhu bag with Kusala, you know, clothing. And he comes to the door and puts on his Kusala uniform. And now here he is. And he talks and he reminisces and he tells stories and blah, blah, blah. And then he takes off Kusala and he goes back and becomes Carl for a while. And I thought, this is really fascinating, because this is exactly what happens to me all the time when I do a presentation, is I drive someplace as Carl. I present as Kusala, and then I have to drive back. And there's a transition point from Kusala to Carl that sometimes takes 15 or 20 minutes. And so I drive really carefully, because Kusala's behind the wheel in the beginning. And he's not quite sure where he's going or what he's supposed to do next. And then Carl materializes, and we make it home safely. So we have this sort of relationship, if you will. And I'm thinking to myself, for instance, when I first met Sarah here, Sarah was actor, single. Sarah met somebody, Joe, great guy. Sarah became wife. Joe became husband. Then Sarah became mom, and Joe became dad. And so these are also different ways of looking at ourselves, different characters we sort of crawl into and become, because it's necessary to look at the world in a different way in order to be a good mom, or to be a good wife, or to be a good single person. Different requirements. And some people make it, some people are able to adjust and transform. Other people are just really fighting it the whole way and saying, I just can't be in this relationship. Or, it's so hard to be a parent because 24/7 I am on call and there's no time for me. Where did I go? And where did you go? You got pushed aside in the same way Carl gets pushed aside. And mom shows up, and mom is present and accounted for. And I can remember when I put my mother to rest, when she passed away, and people got up and they talked about Joyce, my mother's maiden name, birth name. And I thought to myself, I never met Joyce. She was a trip. She was a party girl. She had a lot of ambition. She had a lot of fun. But the woman I met was mom, and she was serious, and she fed us, and she cleaned us, and she encouraged us to go to school. And I'm thinking, it would have been fun to meet Joyce just for a little while, just to have a talk with her. But even in the end, you can't talk to Joyce if you're her son. You're going to talk to mom. So here we are struggling with, who are we today? Are we a blend of everybody we've already been? And the potential of everybody we're going to be? Is that the whole idea? And this evolution of us brings us to a point of selflessness. That we, in the beginning, according to Ram Dass, are in somebody training and we're becoming somebody. And it is necessary to be somebody to give people an idea of who they're talking to and who they're in relationship to. But if you ask them, who are you really? You may get a variety of answers, none of them very good. Okay, so now as we evolve into nobodiness, what we find is sometimes the happiness in later life is dependent on the service and kindness we're doing and not on what we're trying to acquire or to be. At some point, it seems to me, Colonel Sanders aside, we don't need to be successful We don't need to be special. What we need to be is universal. It's more non-dual than specific. And that allows us to live in a way that's appreciated by others. A favorite story of mine, which is I've used before, is a funeral, and the rabbi's at the podium, and as is customary, to say something good about the dearly departed. And he had lived a long life. He was in his 80s when he passed away, and he had been married and had children and grandchildren. And so after the rabbi gave the eulogy, he says, "I'd like to have somebody stand up and say a few good words about Simon, having lived a long life." And there was silence and no movement at all. And the rabbi says, "He must have done something good. He must have been somebody's friend. Please just stand up and share something nice about Simon." Stillness and silence. The rabbi starts to freak out a little bit and says, "I'm not leaving this podium until somebody says something good about Simon." Finally, in the back of the room, the guy stands up and says, "His brother was worse." So as we're going through life, I would like to have somebody stand up and say something nice about me after having lived a life. And along the way, we go from selfish to selfless. Along the way, we evolve from a very dualistic reality, hopefully into a more non-dualistic reality, hopefully a more interconnected and interdependent reality. That can be our personal experience. And there are many ways to do it. And if you play a musical instrument, you probably already know that. If you've been in relationship and required to be selfless for a while, you probably already know that. But it is something that has so much value and is misunderstood. So as I'm thinking about wholeness in Buddhism, I'm thinking we are already there. We are already interconnected and interdependent with everything, and it's the sense of ego that gives us the sense of separateness, which can feel very uncomfortable and very lonely. But it's an illusion. And I know people say life is an illusion, but it's a really important illusion because it's most of our reality, this illusion of our life. And these spiritual non-dual experiences that we may have because of our practice are so temporary, but there's almost like a window into our potential. Could we live there? Could we simply say, "I'm going to leave behind the dual and live in the non-dual"? I don't think humans are set up for that. I think humans are required to defend and define themselves all the time and feel separate so they can use and manipulate the world around them to exist and to survive. If we become one with everything, everything becomes us, and there's nothing we can do or go or say or be. And we need to be and go and say things in order to certify our existence, in order to feel like we are there and connected. But the spiritual path brings us to that place of connection, and then we say, "How am I connected to everything? How am I connected to everything?" And if I was speaking in a Christian church, they might say, "God." Well, then there's the Buddhist guy over there who's not quite sure what it, she, he is. So that may not be a real good connection. Buddhists might say suffering. You know, suffering connects us all. And I would say that's probably more realistic than God. But even better than suffering would be breath. Breath is the foundation of our life. We all have to breathe as humans. In fact, most creatures that live on Earth have to breathe. The fish breathe in a different way. But if you're living on top of the Earth, you're breathing, and that connects all of us. And that should give us a sense of comfort and serenity that we're not alone, even though it seems that way sometimes. We're only alone up here in our heads because of things we've created and things we don't want to participate in, and aversion and attachment, and all that kind of stuff. So this practice that we're doing, sitting here in the present moment, coming to the sensation of breath, which is always happening right now, that allows us to see how we're connected, to see the present moment experience of our life that is connected with all the other present moment experiences of the lives being lived right now. This is like our team. And you notice about spring? Spring is really cool. I have found people look so much better in the spring than they do in the fall. And I'm not sure why. It probably has a lot to do with me. And then I notice all the joy and happiness in the backyard of the meditation center where I live. We have birds chirping and fish being born. And then I see the mouse being eaten by the cat and the bird that falls out of the nest and never makes it back up. And I'm going, whoa, all the joy and happiness of spring is countered by the death and destruction of all those that didn't make it. You know? And I'm going, what? How can I ignore the bad and simply focus on the good? And yet somehow I have to blend both of those to have a realistic perspective of what life means. That every time someone is born, someone's going to die. And lately, more people are being born than dying. You know? We have 7 billion. We lost a lot in Nepal just the other day. It's just so sad to see that destruction and death. You know, for no apparent reason, other than the earth deciding to shake a little bit. Man. Then you have war. I was reading an article that I posted on my Facebook page about war. Somebody did the work. He said, America has been here since 1776 or whenever we started. From that start date until now, we've only had 22 years of peace. 22 years of no war. And I'm thinking, is there something wrong with America? Well, there's probably something wrong with humans. That humans like to kill things. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know why. Why do we take this joy in killing? People love to go fishing. They never call it killing. I'm going to go out and kill some fish today. I feel so calm and relaxed when I'm killing fish. You go, really? That's how you do it, you know? And then they had this picture of this woman that killed this giraffe and laid down next to the giraffe. I'm thinking, what a beautiful creature that giraffe used to be. And yet somehow in her mind, killing it was important. And I'm going, I don't understand why that's the case. I'm thinking through our spiritual practice, we may get to a place where we see how we're connected to the giraffe, how we're connected to the fish, how we're connected to all living things on this earth. And when we're killing them, we're literally killing a part of ourselves. Now, two nights ago, as I lay down to sleep in my bed, I noticed there was a daddy long-legged spider 2 feet away, cozy in the corner. Little web, you know, and there was a little creature in there. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I'm just going to go to sleep. And I'm sure that daddy long legs isn't going to attack me. I'm too big. And sure enough, I slept the whole night and I looked at the next morning and he was there and we were fine. It took about a day and a half and then he went to someplace else. But I didn't have to kill it. I didn't have to take it outside. I probably have less mosquitoes in my room because of the daddy long legs. And so I'm learning now to how to live with insects, you know? And insects were always an issue for me, especially spiders. 8 legs, it's not right, you know? But it's okay now. I'm starting to see I'm connected to them too. They're connected to me. We can live together in harmony. They're exactly where they're supposed to be. I may be out of place, but they just find a corner and that's fine for them, you know? So as I look at wholeness, I see wholeness is a product of our practice. The interconnectedness and interdependence that is available to us, that realization happens through continual practice. And now and then we get a little taste of it. If we don't pull back, if we don't freak out, we can see it as our potential. And then our job is to dance in the relative and the ultimate. To dance in the relative and the ultimate. To live in the relative but appreciate the ultimate as being part of our life as well. And all those creatures out there, rather than killing them, why don't we try feeding them? You're at the taco stand, you know, and you got the little taco shell. Maybe just take off a piece and feed it to the birds that are there waiting. I went to get a falafel in Westwood the other day. Birds right on the sidewalk. They like falafel too. So I'm starting to see, yeah, feeding is really good. You know, it's fun to feed things. And if you're a wife or a husband and have a family, you know about feeding. It's what you do. You got breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Feed the gang. Single guy, lives at the meditation center. He's got cats and birds, spiders and fish, feeding the little guys, you know. But all together, we are encouraging life to exist and prosper. We are hopefully going after less destruction and more creation, or at least sustaining the creation that finally made it to Earth. What a rare event that is. So, wholeness seems to me to be the direct experience of the interconnectedness and the interdependence of all phenomena. Nirvana seems to me to be our salvation as a Buddhist. In our Buddhist practice, we can have both wholeness and salvation, but it is defined and understood in a different way from the other religions in the world. So is our religion the best religion? It is for Buddhists. But that's about as far as I can go. It's good for Buddhists. So I'm going to stop here and see if anybody has a comment. We have a hand in the back.
So with your two identities, Carl and Kusa, have you found that as you practice, like they become more integrated, or like they become closer to one another, or have they still felt as distinct as they've ever been?
Yes. So the question is, as I practice, is one identity becoming stronger than the other?
Or are they integrating?
Or are they integrating and we find harmony amongst the group of Kusala and Carl? Yeah, you know, it's fascinating because I realize I can never get rid of Carl because Carl has to pay taxes every year. You know, and we don't want Carl not to pay taxes. And Kusala doesn't have a social security number. So we have this, you know, identity, and it's not a confusing identity. It's what's appropriate for a particular environment. So if I'm driving too fast and pulled over by the CHP, I need to be Carl. I need to be the guy in that driver's license, and I need to react like that. Kusala might say, well, we're all connected. We're all interdependent. And that might lead to my, you know, it might lead to me going to the county hospital for the mentally ill. We don't want to go there either. So we need to keep it under control. But I find sometimes when I speak most unskillfully, Carl is there. And when I'm speaking most skillfully, Kusala is sort of leading the pack. And I need to not have a category error and have too much Carl and not enough Kusala. I need to find the blend, but I need to also know who's showing up to give these talks. And today it was Kusala. I'm happy to say. Thank you for the question. Yeah.
What you're talking about reminds me of what Carl Jung talked about, integrating the shadow.
Yeah.
The shadow was named Carl. I have one too. His name is Carrie. And he said that the reason why we have to integrate the shadow is that's where all the energy is.
It could be. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
very powerful to do it. But it puts me in, when I'm able to integrate the two, I have all that energy, almost that raw animal energy, but I can use it for rational and more humane purposes.
Yes, yes. In fact, I've been in situations where kindness was called for. You know, I might be impatient, there might be something wrong according to me, and I'm about to fix it, and I'm about to tell the world that they are going down the wrong path. And then I have to say to myself, but what would Kusala do? What would he do? And by having another perspective, a whole other perspective I can draw from, I sometimes become more skillful rather than less skillful. And I'm thinking it might work the same way if you're in a relationship. So you ask your partner, what would you do? Not that you would always do what he or she does, but you would consider it as being an option. And so I have done that with just one person, me.
A friend of mine reminded me of the three gates of speech. Is it true? Is it kind? And is it necessary? And she piped up, any two will do. But all three are really remarkable. And I find that for me, the necessary part is the critical. Is what I'm saying right now necessary to me or to this room?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I was just watching a few episodes of the old Kung Fu TV show. There's a channel 2.2 on antenna TV, over-the-air TV, and it's called Binge TV. And what they do is they play every episode of a series. Right now they're playing The Millionaire. And I used to watch that when I was a kid. I never realized how funny it was, you know? So there's a scene where David Carradine, as Kane, is sitting next to the headstone of his father. And he wants some information about where his brother is, where his family went, and they won't give it to him. So he sits down next to the gravestone. And he's there for 10 days. And finally, on the 11th day, the guy comes up and says, if you stay there and don't eat or drink, you will die. And he says, so I will die. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that's according to your triad, you know, necessary, kind, and that might fit all of those. So it seems sometimes on our spiritual path, the most appropriate thing to do is nothing. To work it over in our head, all the options and all the outcomes, but none of them may be satisfactory or kind or necessary. And so we sit in meditation practicing doing nothing. For hours at a time, for days and years at a time, practicing doing nothing. So when the event occurs where nothing is appropriate, we are present and accounted for. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And to try to explain that to people that don't meditate, it makes us sound like we're a bunch of crazy people, you know? And then when it is appropriate to do something, then we are there as well. But our mindset is different. Our mindset is not doing it because we're going to make the world a better place. Our mindset is doing it because suffering will be reduced. And from a Buddhist perspective, that's the direction we seem to go in. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Yes.
I'm glad you spoke on interconnectedness today because I've been thinking about it a lot. This last year I've had the opportunity to babysit one of my best friend's children. And she just turned a year old. And it became very apparent to me how connected I was as a child to everything around me, to nature, to some people, but mainly nature and animals. And where that went along the way, I don't know. And then, in starting my practice a number of years ago, over time, reconnecting to that interconnectedness, and then feeling that being alive, being a human being, is an impediment to that interconnectedness in some ways.
It could seem that way, but I think in the beginning, our connectedness is for our survival. That we have to connect in a very special way, a lot of eye contact, a lot of cooing, a lot of crying, in order to survive. Then, in an interesting transformation, in the same way the mother bird kicks the baby birds out of the nest so they can fly, we go from that interconnection for our survival to being independent for our survival. That we have to become that somebody. So we have the years of schooling, we have our parents talking to us, telling us how good we are and what we need to do, and blah, blah, blah. So we go through that part of our life in an independent, separate way. And then, hopefully, through our spiritual practice, we then go back to being connected, but not as the child to the mother, but as the human to the wholeness of the universe. We come home again in a very specific way because we can't forget or lose everything we've learned or experienced on the way. But we need to be able to transcend that in order to be interconnected again. So we're interconnected in the beginning for survival. We're independent in the middle for our survival. We become interconnected again in a very special transcendent way for our death, because we're going home. We're going to be, again, one with everything. But not forever for a Buddhist. And then we're going to come back again. And it could be just to get even with all the people we didn't like in the last one. We don't know. But.
An interesting upshot. I mean, I thank you for that.
Yeah.
But an interesting upshot for me was I spend an enormous amount of time alone, doing what I do and doing nothing. And I used to be lonely. And through my practice, that interconnectedness makes me feel incredibly held in the world by everything and everyone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And my experience when I was felt separate and stuttering is that everybody in the room was a stranger. And when I felt that sense of interconnectedness, everybody in the room looked familiar. And it was fascinating, you know. And I walk up and say, "Where do we know each other from?" And they'd say, "We don't." I said, "Oh." So there is that change of perspective that occurs, and it's wonderful when it does, because loneliness is so different from loneliness, aloneness. So being alone it can be a good thing for personal evolution, but being together can be a good thing as well. Yeah, good. Thanks. Thank you. How about you, Holly? Any comments?
No comments.
Okay. Good. Well, I guess we've come to the end of our dialogue. And we have a few minutes left. So why don't we meditate just for a few minutes before the loving kindness, and we can feel the energy and the connectedness in that silence. And as soon as one sound is made, we are forever separate. But we have to be to go out the door, so that's okay.